Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Thursday, September 11th, welcome, friends, to the show. I am Cherry Gregg.
And I am Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Today, we're going to dive into some sobering data that suggests American students are falling behind. This data comes from a national test, often called the nation's report card, and it shows that 12th graders are doing worse in math and reading, and 8th graders are doing worse in science. Some of these trends predate the pandemic, but things sure seem to have gotten worse over the last 5 years. We have a pair of experts in studio. We're going to talk about why this data is the way it is and what we can do to change the trajectory. We're asking you, why do you think students are losing ground in reading, math, and science, and what should we do about it? Call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org if you're on YouTube or Facebook. Drop a comment in the chat.
Yeah, I would love to hear if some young people are listening today. I mean, they're probably in school. It is Thursday.
Kids, but yeah.
Folks who may have graduated and
absenteeism is one of the problems in the data. So, yeah.
So if you have some commentary, I'd love to hear what you think. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org.
It's also DJ of the day, Cherry.
Yes,
because it's
is.
A Thursday. We will end the show with a song picked by one of you. It has to be on the theme of today's show, which is education school,
report cards, yeah,
learning,
all those things.
Report
yeah.
cards.
Mm-hmm.
The song picker will be executive producer Kevin.
We're going to call him EP Kev.
EP Kev. That's who you have to convince today. So send those song suggestions to studio2@whyy.org before 12:30 for your chance to be the DJ of the day.
Now, I'm looking forward to hearing those picks.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I want to hear what
it's.
What
there's
DJ
a lot
is.
Of songs on this
mm-hmm.
topic. Trio of local news stories, Jerry.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Somber moment. Local reaction is pouring in following the recent killing of influential conservative activist Charlie Kirk. The 31-year-old was shot at Utah Valley University on Wednesday during an event kicking off a tour of college campuses by his nonprofit, Turning Point USA. And as of noon today, his killer is still unknown. Local lawmakers from both sides of the aisle in our area spoke out on social media condemning the act of violence against Kirk. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro posted on X saying, "Political violence has no place in our country." He says we must speak with moral clarity. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy also wrote on X, "The murder of Charlie Kirk during an event on a college campus is abhorrent. Political violence has no place in our nation." I have to say, on campuses, the response was mixed. Kirk was known to say some very controversial things. And some young Republicans on local campuses, they said they received texts telling them that Kirk deserved what he got because of his rhetoric. But many young conservatives in our region, they said they liked and respected Kirk because he was willing to go on campuses and meet young people where they are, debate them, engage them in dialogue, even with liberals who disagreed.
Yeah, also note, because you mentioned Governor Josh Shapiro, he also asked that Commonwealth flags be lowered to half-mast following the lead of President Trump, who mm-hmm. ordered all American flags to half-mast until Sunday, I believe.
Yeah, and we're going to be having a broader conversation of this about this topic because it keeps happening, this political violence.
Story number two. Philadelphia is no longer America's poorest big city. And for the first time since 1979, fewer than 20% of Philadelphians live in poverty. That's according to new census data that was presented this morning by the Inquirer. Among the 10 most populous American cities, Houston now has the highest percentage of people living in poverty. For Philadelphia, this is a continuation of a long-term trend that started in 2012. Our city's poverty rate back in 2011 was around 28%.
Wow.
Now it's around 19%. What does this mean? Why did this happen? There's not one simple explanation, but it certainly is a notable shift.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things that I used to dislike saying when I was a reporter, because I covered marginalized communities, poverty issues, social justice issues. I'm just so glad we can finally stop saying that Philadelphia is the poorest of America's big cities. you know, unfortunately, Houston has to say that now. But I would love to hear more about how this happened. I know a lot of folks have said they've been priced out of Philly and they moved out of the city. We've had
that's important to note
who are wealthy, who've moved into the city. There are people who've upskilled, right, and got better jobs. And so they can they've moved themselves out of poverty. So there's you know, many different reasons, but still 1 in 5 people are still living in poverty in Philadelphia. So there's a lot of work to do.
Yeah. Whenever you hear a data point like this, it's so important to interrogate what is this data measuring?
Yeah.
Right. And this is the percentage of Philadelphians living in poverty. So if someone living in poverty moves outside of the city of Philadelphia,
they're no longer. Yeah,
exactly. And the same could be said the reverse. And so the thing that I think most officials and policymakers want to measure is how many people are being lifted out of poverty. And I actually thought this was really admirable. I rarely do this, but, you know, talk about the statements of public officials. But the Parker administration was asked about this data by the Inquirer. And they said the typical thing, like, you know, this is encouraging. It's not enough, blah, blah, blah. Then they also pointed to a recent Harvard study that showed that Greater Philadelphia ranked 50th out of 50 major metro areas for economic mobility. And I say it's admirable because what they said was, okay, this is fine, but like clearly it's not good enough.
No,
because the thing we're really trying to measure is whether or not people are able to improve their lives and live the lives they want to live. And by this other measure, we're really not doing great. Now, that was the whole metro area, not just Philadelphia. But I just wanted to give them a hat tip because I feel like
they're not encouraged by this. They're still, but they know there's a lot of
But you know how this
do.
Works.
Yeah.
If there's a chance to take a victory lap, people usually take the victory lap. And I just was I was surprised pleasantly that they said, yes, OK, this is good. But here's where work needs to be done.
Yeah. A lot of work to do. But the city is moving in the right direction.
Speaking of moving through the city of Philadelphia.
Get ready to hit the brakes, people. And drive speed limit in Philly. Why? Because on Monday, speed cameras will go live. And if you go over the limit, smile, because your tag will likely be on camera, people, and you could get a warning in the mail. The city is activating speed cameras in 15 spots along Broad Street and will begin mailing warnings to drivers caught going more than 11 miles over the 25 mile per hour speed limit. Yes, it's 25 miles per hour if you've been gunning it up and down Broad Street. All
yeah,
right?
You wouldn't know that from the speed people actually drive.
You know who you are, by the way. The grace period for the warnings is 60 days, again, beginning Monday. After that, violators will start getting fines of up to $150 per ticket. Ouch, because that could hurt. And the goal here is to bring down the number of traffic deaths in Philadelphia. Speed cameras have brought the city a lot of success, Avi, off of along Roosevelt Boulevard by reducing crashes and deaths. And if you remember, the boulevard used to be the deadliest stretch of road in the city. Now Broad Street is the most dangerous stretch of road.
Yeah, this has become a very popular tool in the toolbox for reducing traffic fatalities and injuries. And I, you know, I, as someone who drives along Broad Street, not infrequently, I live very close to Broad Street. I understand that feeling of feeling like I could go faster on this road, right? Because it's so broad. And that feeling, if I'm not going as fast as I could be going, that I'm running late or I feel frustrated. Yeah. And I wish we all could get like a printout at the start of every drive of like, if you go 25, this is the time you will arrive at your destination. If you go 35, this is the time you
will
arrive.
Which is probably the same time.
And it's probably the same time. You know what I mean? Because of traffic lights and traffic patterns and all sorts of other things. And it's so hard to divorce that sensation that you get from going slower than you want to go versus your actual goal, which is getting there safely and quickly.
And I've had the thing where somebody has honked their horn at me, you know, cut me off, done all these things only to get stopped at the red light. And I'm like, you did all that.
It happens all the time.
To be stopped right in front of me.
It happens all the time.
But we want to save lives. We want to save lives.
I just want to say real quick, we weren't planning on talking about this before in this roundup, but the big news here at WHYY this morning, you know what I'm going to talk about?
Oh, yeah.
The Hawk.
Oh, yeah. It looked a little, it made WHYY look a little, edgy.
There was just a hawk sitting outside WHYY headquarters today.
On the logo.
Just sitting there on the logo, welcoming people in. It was a real hawk. And then they posted it online. and started a naming contest on WHYY's Instagram page. And people have all
sorts
of...
What are the options here?
Okay. You want me to read some?
Yeah, read some.
Marty Moss, Colleen. You like that one?
Yes.
Andreas, our producer, Lakshmi Wing.
Okay.
That's a good one, right?
I like that.
That's a good one. Someone did say, and I feel bad that I didn't even think about this, Avian Birdman Errant.
That is good. You got a shout out there. That's pretty cool.
And for you, I was thinking, what was the one I was thinking for you? It was like a rhyme with cherry.
Uh-oh.
It left me.
It's all right.
It wasn't scary, Greg. It was something like snary.
Snary.
Snary, Greg.
Oh,
how about
goodness.
That? Do you like that?
That could work for a hawk. By the way, I like Moscowing. I
think that's the winner for me.
I like that one.
All right. Keep the puns coming and keep listening to Studio 2.
We're some
we'll be right back.
Folks over here.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. According to new national testing data, America's 12th graders are reading and doing math at historically low levels. Meanwhile, 8th graders are backsliding in science. The data worries many education experts. And while some of these trends predate the pandemic, things seem to have worsened in the last 5 years.
But why? And what can we do to change this troubling trajectory? We'll discuss with a pair of local experts. Donna Cooper is the executive director of Children First and worked as an education policy expert under Governor Ed Rendell. Donna, welcome back to the program.
Great to see you guys.
Farah Jimenez is the president and CEO of the Philadelphia Education Fund and previously served on the city's School Reform Commission. Farah, nice to see you again.
Thank you. And I'm honored to be here with Donna. She knows everything.
She kind of does. She kind of does. And by the way, that means all of you at home are going to learn everything very soon.
Yes.
But we also want to hear your thoughts.
We definitely do. Those of you at home, on the road, elsewhere, the question of the day, why do you think students are losing ground in reading, math, and science? And what should we do about it? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, share the video. But also keep those comments coming in the live chat.
So just to give folks a little catch up here, this batch of tests was given in 2024. The last time these same tests were given, I believe, was 2019. Mm-hmm. And on every measure, basically, there was a downward trend from 2019 to 2024. So this is 8th grade science, 12th grade math, 12th grade reading. These tests are given to kids all over the country. Not every kid, but it's supposed to be a representative sample of students across the country. And a lot of folks in education really care about this particular signal amid all the noise. So Donna, I'm curious how much you care. Like, how important do you think this particular batch of test readings is?
Well, I mean, first of all, in testing, there are blips, and one could hope in the next 5 years the dip would disappear, but I don't think that's likely. Mm-hmm. So I think this is very troubling. I think it's a real canary in the coal mine for us to understand that strategies that we've tried to put in place since 2019 aren't sufficient.
Why don't you think it's a blip?
Well, first of all, because it was a 5-year period, so yeah. You have a pretty long period of time, and most of these trends have not been going in the right direction nationally. Now, Pennsylvania, we might find out when the state tests come out, might do a little bit better than others because our state assessments are really tough. Mm-hmm. And so maybe we will have gone down less than Arkansas and Mississippi. We'll see. One can hope. But I do think that these are really troubling trends.
Yeah. Farah, do you agree? Do you feel like this is something real as opposed to, hey, a few tests?
No, absolutely. And we have to be looking at data generally to inform the way that we provide instruction to young people and our own global competitiveness as a nation. So I think it's really troubling that we're seeing the trends continue. To Donna's point, though, in terms of the Commonwealth, where do we sit is going to be an important indicator. The last time we did this assessment, Pennsylvania actually sat around the middle. Mm-hmm. Of course, the data is not, I'm sharing that as for Pennsylvania. When you disaggregate the data based on demographics or cities, there's going to be great variation, which are worth talking about. But Mississippi is one of the states that saw tremendous gains, actually. And it was because in the past, when they looked at their NAEP scores, they decided to take a really strong route in terms of investing on new curriculum and professional development of educators in the hopes that it would rank rise them up from 50th, which is where they ranked, to where they stand now, which is closer to 19th.
Yeah. I want to bring in a caller because, you know, we have somebody who works in education on the line. We have Lori from the Palisades School District in Upper Bucks County on the line. Lori, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thanks for having me. Yes, I'm a reading specialist, and I've been working in a rural school district for the past 15 years. And I have a couple of comments, one that's hopeful and one that's sort of a call to action. So I'll try to make it brief. The first one is, from a curriculum standpoint, our state and our county has been really great about offering explicit systematic phonics instruction along with knowledge-based curriculum for many years. But not all states have been doing that. You're probably familiar with the term science of reading.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So as we see that becoming more regulated, more of a requirement that districts have that training, we're hoping to see those scores improve nationally. So that's hopeful. The more concerning part for me is that as I've raised my kids as well as taught, we cannot underestimate the negative impact of students using technology. It is a demand on their attention that takes away other activities, including reading. Yeah. And reading is the foundation of a democracy, so we really need to make sure that kids are having the time to do it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Should we end the show now?
Yeah, exactly. Lori broke it down. Yeah, but this sort of made me think, because the last time that we had these tests done, it was 2019. A lot has changed in those years in the interim. And I want to kind of go over some of the things that you both have seen shift since 2019. And the pandemic is a big glaring one, but technology, there's other things. And Donna, could you kind of go down the laundry list of things we've seen shift?
Yeah, another thing we've seen shift is what Lori brought up, which is Pennsylvania said the idea of how we teach our kids reading was crazy. And we needed to do a much more evidence-based approach. Now, she's lucky Palisades is following through on that, and our state law does say school districts need to do it. But
yeah,
a lot of suburban school districts around Philly have rejected the idea that they have to update their reading curricula. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot more to do to really adhere to this. And these 12th graders that were doing badly in reading, they were taught in the way that we know was a mistake for decades.
Yeah, this data is probably not going to bear that out. Because
not at all. It's proof positive that the reading...
Sure,
yeah.
Sure. The reading instruction that we're talking about is really targeted toward younger students, and they would not have been part of that.
The only thing I would add beyond that is Lori said reading is important to democracy, and that's of course true, but reading is important to instruction. Science and math depend on reading skills. I mean, Farah spends her life on math and science skills, and it's impossible to help kids develop those without strong reading skills. I mean, I can go into my own sense about it, but I don't know if you have a comment about what...
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so absolutely, it's important. In fourth grade, there's a campaign in Philadelphia called Read by Fourth, because it uses the data that shows that it's important to learn how to read, because once you learn how to read, it's what lets you become more competent in reading to learn, right? And so similarly, in eighth grade, there's efforts afoot to look at the instruction of algebra, because algebra teaches computational thinking, and it's the kinds of opens the door for more elevated math and science
skills. It's essentially
right. These are two gateway skills, and so obviously fourth for reading, eighth grade for algebra. But we also had to change the way we do curriculum, because there was a movement for changing the way that we taught math, and that led to students then having to change the way they learned math in order to be able to be competent in algebra. So what we were teaching in the elementary schools weren't setting students up for success in those eighth grade, when they were starting to now attack more challenging mathematical problems. So curriculum fed with professional development is really the main strategy. And you're seeing states where there are gains, they're really finding that combination in a thoughtful way that's driving real results.
So kind of what changed, you're telling me that there was a bad, there was a, I guess, ineffective way of teaching kids how to read. There was some ways that the math wasn't working. Technology came in there. Are there other things that sort of, you know, you've seen the big shift that would have led to this?
You know, when this data really was a smack at the head for me to think about how poorly we really understood COVID. So of course there's still learning loss associated with COVID, but it's deeper. So kids lost 2 years of instruction. And so you were in second grade, you got back into school somewhere late fourth, early fifth grade. And we almost pretended that didn't happen. Mm. When you went to your fourth grade class, mm-hmm. nobody went back maybe for a couple of weeks and taught you what you would have missed in second and third in most school districts. So there was extra help to get up to fourth grade, but there was an entire 180 days of school over 2 years, meaning 2 years, 360 days, that you lost instruction. And so I think we were naive about the degree to which fundamental learning loss occurred. We thought kids would be able to catch up, and we didn't do enough to understand what catch up would be. So it's not just like in general the learning loss, but I think what was interesting to me about this is that you remember school districts were under massive attack during COVID for shutting down. Mm-hmm. And I think that cowed school districts from thinking big about what they needed to do when they reopened. I think people might have thought
sort of
about
just fighting to stay alive instead of
staying
alive
and saying maybe kids need to redo second grade again. Mm-hmm. We understand they've aged beyond second grade, mm-hmm. but maybe we need a second, third grade recreation, mm-hmm. and everybody will be held back to catch up for what they missed. That didn't happen. And it's not a surprise to me that these kids who were affected by COVID 5 years ago are performing badly on 8th and 12th grade assessments because they lost 2 years of instruction.
What do you think about the impact of COVID, Farah?
Absolutely. I would echo Donna. And some of the work that we do at the Philadelphia Education Fund embeds us in Philly public schools. And we were embedded in those schools during COVID. So that means virtually embedded in those schools. And one of the takeaways that we had is while we were showing overall 80% average daily attendance in Philadelphia schools, when you went into classrooms, because there was this kind of idea that somehow if you take the attendance at the beginning of the day, it would stay consistent through the day. But kids are on their laptops, so they can come and go as they wished. And so we were seeing in the classroom where we were working, average daily attendance about 40%, 43%. So when you're not showing up, you're obviously not going to be getting the information instruction that you need. And learning virtually is difficult. A lot of universities talk about the struggle of that, that they find that students who need more supports, it's better for them to be in person than to take a virtual program because it requires a certain amount of self-discipline and self-mastery in order and the ability to teach yourself in order to be successful in those programs. I will say that there's some light in that there are national efforts like Attendance Works that are looking at how do you drive belonging and connection, and going back to the social media issue, if you're on your phones and you're not creating that sense of belonging and connection because you're not having true human interactions, you haven't developed the skills of building relationships because on the social media landscape, you don't really have to build deep relationships. It's hard to form belonging and connection to your academic setting. If we can get more students attending and feeling connected to the schools, I think there's opportunity for gains.
By the way, according to the nation's that report card, nearly a third of 12th graders reported missing three or more days from school in the previous month in 2024. And I wanted to ask a follow-up question about attendance. I remember growing up, like, you had to be on death's door to miss school. I don't know how it was in your house, but there, I feel like there was a cultural shift where, you know, during COVID, you were told to stay home. And I think it kind of extended past COVID and there became a more lackadaisical approach to attendance. Do you feel like there was a culture shift?
I feel like there was a significant culture shift, and it's not just in Philly. I think it's across the state that people think of school attendance in a much more lackadaisical way. And it's going to take a lot to change that. Maybe results like this will cause people to rethink this. But districts really need to talk to parents about the data shows if you miss more than 10 days of school, you're basically cutting your grade in half. So there, you can't miss a lot. A lot happens every day. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think there was a massive shift. Now, Philly has historically had a attendance problem. Like, you know, there's a lot of things that are natural to Philadelphians, some of which are good, some of which are bad. You know, the idea that we get serious about attendance is something that's going to be essential to changing the trajectory of this.
Go ahead, Farah.
I was going to say, culturally setting too, speaking to some truth about Philadelphia in terms of attendance, but I know that this can happen elsewhere, is that the students most likely to be absent in Philadelphia are 12th graders. The students right after them are kindergartners.
Mm.
So
the
youngest, 12th graders have agency. Kindergartners don't. So that's it's speaking to parental connection to education as a pathway for their own young people's success.
Just to reiterate something Cherry said, so 31% of 12th graders reported missing three or more days of school in 2024. In 2019, that number was 26%. So 5 percentage point increase in absenteeism. Let's bring in a caller now today. By the way, the topic is the nation's declining education test scores based on some new data from the nation's report card. Connor from Wilmington, Delaware is on line two and has something to add to the conversation. Hey, Connor, thanks for being on Studio Two. What's your question or comment?
Hey, thanks for having me. And this actually ties in pretty well, I think, with the recent comments about attendance. My spouse is a high school teacher here in Delaware and has students routinely receiving calls in class from their employers asking them to come in immediately or asking them to, you know, miss class other days to cover shifts. And a lot of these students are, you know, primary support financially for their families in the low-income districts. So I'd be interested to see what your guests have to say about that.
Thanks, Connor. And let me add this comment from Rob online, who says the number one predictor of student test scores is parental income. Do we just have a greater proportion of youth from lower income families these days? Donna, you want to take a crack at that?
Yeah, well, absolutely true. So these results are about public school students only. We have no idea what the performance of kids in religious or private schools are. They could be better, they could be worse. Nobody knows. But in the case of public schools, increasingly the share of students attending are coming from very low income families. So in 2013, we hit that sort of Grand Canyon, where we got to the other side, where a majority of kids attending public school are in poverty. And that's grown every year since 2013. So it is true what the caller's saying, that kids are coming in now with families that are less able to support them. And I don't mean that intellectually. Parents might be working two jobs. You might have a single parent who's not as available to help them do homework. They may not have had educational attainment that's sufficient enough to support their kid, but they're less able to support them. And that's increasing as a share of students in every single classroom. And so that is a definite contributor to this, although the test results show that kids of all incomes are doing worse.
Yep.
So poor kids lost more ground, but all kids lost ground. So it's important.
It can't be just that, is what you're saying.
And it's important we don't think it is. It's not. The data does not say that. It's much more structural. And I think the technology issue of kids getting a call from their employer.
But we haven't talked about that yet. Social media, technology, distraction. I mean, I'll let Pharaoh jump in here. And then Donna, you can respond as well. Like, what role do you see that playing in this whole conversation?
Oh.
I know you guys work with lots of young people.
Yeah, no, it's significant. And during COVID, one of the things that we saw is that students were attending class virtually, but they were attending class while at work. And so how much attention do you think that student is giving to their academic program while they're at work with the laptop open?
Yeah.
And so I think that is an onset of a culture around what is education, what is school, what does it mean to me, and how much do I need to be committed to it? And parents, a willingness to support that, because some of it was also talking to parents saying, your child is not performing well in school. They really should quit that job. And so some parents bought into that and some parents weren't particularly supportive. The social media, though, has more to do, I think, with lack of attention span, the ability to sit and really challenge oneself with things that require rigorous thinking to stay in the challenge, and that kind of grit and resilience that young people need in order to tackle academic subjects that they don't immediately grasp. I think we want things to be very easy and quick, and learning is a commitment that requires full attention.
Yeah, a lot of students like it when the school takes their cell phones and says, you know, we even had some student voices on our show when we talked about this. Students actually like, they can focus better. They don't have to worry about what's going on online. How big of a deal is technology in class? You know,
but I think it has two layers.
Yeah.
One is, yes, like nobody should be getting a call in class.
Yeah,
so,
okay,
that's a given. We need to take the cell phones out of schools. And they need to turn them in when they walk in and get them on the way out. We all went to school. Nobody
didn't
could call
phones.
Us. And we all survived.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's more fear that parents have for safety. School shooting yesterday, I get it. But there are ways to solve for that it don't involve kid having a phone in their pocket or on their wrist. Because the other problem that's happening is they're taking cell phones, but they're keeping the smartwatches, which is got to go too. Like, get it. We understand these things. But to Farah's point, the data on attention span is very concerning. Mm. And kids' attention span is diminishing. Reading teachers, I wish Lori from Palisades was still on.
Yeah.
I would imagine that she has some students, probably a greater proportion than in the past, who have a hard time persisting through long reading segments. Mm-hmm. And if you can't do that, how do you do a math equation that's in writing? And how do you get up to date on science? Yeah. And so this pervasiveness and the social media companies making sure they're doing everything they can to shorten kids' attendance span is at odds with improving the educational quality achievement of our kids and diminishing our standing globally.
That's a huge force everyone's up against, though. And yeah. I guess the question is, if you're a teacher in a classroom, what do you do about it? Like, what is a way to teach that allows you to beat, you know, the phone, allows you to lengthen an attention span? I mean, that sounds so hard, Donna.
Well, I think there's an even deeper part of that, which is that we in this country drive the best and the brightest into high paying professions like lawyers and doctors. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of all of us go to jobs and we are good as we can be, but we're not the most creative, the most ingenious, the most facile in working in complicated situations. In fact, the teacher corps comes in general from the bottom half of the SATs.
Yeah.
And so they're walking into a class where kids are 5 years behind, where kids are 2 years behind from COVID, where there's a shortened attention span, where they still have a cell phone in their pocket, and they are expected, without any support, unless Farah's around to do PD, to come up with strategies to compensate for that.
Yeah.
Now, so what do we need? We need a lot more, Farah said at the top of the show, professional development and curricula that's responsive to the reality of these kids. And we need to attract the best and the brightest into the teaching profession.
But by the way, I want to read this comment, and maybe you can piggyback on this, Farah. Bro's a fan on YouTube says, very few of the smart kids in my kids' high school class became teachers. We need to make education more attractive to high caliber people. Also, my kid's second grade teacher could barely write a decent sentence in parent email. Your comments. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah. No, we do a lot of work in teacher talent pipeline. And one of the elements of our work is to do collective impact around STEM and STEM education. So bringing together educators and districts and industry and the city to solve for how do we build, how do we solve for the fact that students of color, particularly African-American and Latino students and young women are underrepresented in STEM as a career and academic pathway. And a lot of it is, you know, how are we developing teachers who reflect them in the classroom? How are we, a lot of our STEM teachers in particular are not themselves STEM professionals. They didn't get a STEM degree and they're being taught, they're trying to teach content that they themselves aren't super comfortable with themselves. So we want to develop more young people's interest in teaching as a credible and exciting career pathway. But we also have an opportunity to help people who are interested, who come from those fields, to find themselves in the classroom as kind of a second career. And I know there have been efforts at multiple districts, including the Philadelphia School District, to help those people make the transition. Teaching is different. I think all of us went to school and we all assume we know what it is to be a teacher. We have no idea.
No,
I know
it's hard.
We have no idea.
Aaliyah on Facebook says, number one, in terms of what's driving this, we don't pay our teachers enough. Two, we do not protect our teachers from the physical violence of students and parents. Three, we expect our teachers to be social workers and teach. It's impossible.
I'm going
to
add one other thing I don't think people realize. Teachers don't have control over their day. All of us are used to having a lot of flexibility in our day. When you're teaching, you are set those hours in front of those students. You don't get to run an errand in the middle of the day or take a phone call in the middle of the day. It's really very, very constraining, and people want flexibility today.
Yeah, you can't work from home either. You got to be in that classroom. Yeah.
Much more to come on today's topic, which is the nation's declining test scores, why it's happening, and what we can do to fix it. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. Keep the calls and emails coming. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Javi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. This hour, we're talking about a new Department of Education report that found declining test scores for high school students. The nation's report card, as it's called, found 12th graders are falling behind in math and reading and 8th graders in science. So what does this say about K-12 education in America? Our question to you, our listeners, is this: why do you think students are losing ground in reading, math, and science? And what should we do about it? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, share this video and leave the comments in the chat.
Our guests this hour are Donna Cooper, Executive Director of Children First, and Farah Jimenez, President and CEO of the Philadelphia Education Fund. Let's bring in a caller here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is Lou from East Coventry, Pennsylvania on line 3. Hey, Lou, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hey, how are you? Thank you so much for your time. I just wanted to reach out and mention that I have been a teacher for 15 years. I started in 2003, making $27,000 a year, just working from 5 a.m. to 8 p.m. every night, and got to the point where, it was like I was fighting schools, I was fighting the district. I started at a very small progressive school where you were really allowed to be responsive to the students, and it was amazing. But after moving from that school, it was just, you know, fighting against curriculum and all these pieces that made sense in theory, but, you know, in practice in the classroom weren't very helpful. So I think it's a lot that's going on, everything you've mentioned before, but also just the fact that, you know, why would people who can make more money and take care of their families doing other things, give up all that time and really be in a heartbreaking situation, you know, watching things not work for kids. So I think a lot of people just leave the profession for that reason as well.
Thank you. That's Lou from East Coventry, Pennsylvania. What a testimony.
Donna, you were shaking your head there. Yeah.
Yeah, we have such a severe teacher shortage because of this. So I can just give you the example. In the Philadelphia School District, we started the school year with more than 300 vacancies.
Wow.
So, like, we have people who are choosing other professions. And what's troubling to me about the test scores is the narrative in Washington about how they're being understood. Mm-hmm. So the Secretary of Education, Linda McMahon, who I think is a very smart person, her basic takeaway from this, or at least the talking point that she was given, I don't know which it is, was that this is another reason that we should give education back to the states. Mm-hmm. Now, first of all, that advances a myth that states aren't in control of education. States actually decide what kids learn, and states are the lion's share of funding of education. Federal funds are 7% of education funding. So her narrative that, this says we should give education back to the state, as opposed to, this should be a call to arms to figure out what role us as the federal government, we play a small role, but what role we could play so that states and school districts could be more successful. That's how Ronald Reagan responded to educational challenges. That's how George Bush responded to educational challenges, and even his son. So this departure from, there is no federal role, and this being used as an argument to shut down the Department of Education is very disheartening in terms of what it means for the capacity of the nation to respond.
And I also wonder, because the Department of Education has had massive cuts of staff and all sorts of things, and it's going to affect the testing. Just your thoughts on just even being able to keep track of how our students are doing now that there are so many cuts within the DOE.
Well, the irony in kind of looking at the NAEP as an informing how education is working in the United States is great when you consider that one of the first actions that was taken at the U.S. Department of Education was to eliminate the Institute for Educational Statistics. So one of the very arms of the U.S. Department of Education that helps inform our understanding about what works and what doesn't work was the first thing that was eliminated. So I don't know how one expects to understand at the federal level or even the local level what is it that we can be doing if we're not allowed to use, we're not investing in the data that's necessary to test ideas and learn from them.
Yeah. What do you think about the federal role, Farah? Donna points out that it's always been limited.
No.
And I guess there is a question of what can or should be done from Washington to chart a new course on education. How do you think about that generally?
So the Department of Education was a separation, basically. There used to be that function with health and welfare and this idea that the federal government plays a very limited role in certain functions. I think it always has played a quite limited role. But like Donna said, there is an opportunity for it to define its role as being the thinker. Mm. And that's why when the Institute of Educational Statistics was eliminated, it's the reason that they do the NAEP, right? So it's an opportunity for one place to aggregate all the information across all of our states and territories and to try and understand what's working well, how do we help support replication of that, if that's a strategy, because ultimately education, while it is locally controlled, it is a national benefit. If we educate our population, we're going to do better in terms of all of our industries, our ability to continue to innovate and to be a leader on the global stage. But if we're expecting our states to do it with any real support from someone who's able to look at it from kind of seeing the forest rather than the trees level, yeah. It's a missed opportunity.
Yeah, I want to read this comment from Sid, who says, parents depend upon the schools to educate their children. Wrong, he says in all caps. Schools are a supplement to what should be happening at home, making sure children can spell their names and know their colors before entering school, taking children to the arts, museums, and the library regularly, checking homework, and actively participating in their child's education. I want to point out the fact that those who are doing really well in these schools, the 90th percentile and up, they're still doing better or they're holding the line.
Yep.
And so if you're a parent, you're hearing this, there are clearly some kids doing okay, and if not better. So what do you think is the big separation? And I wonder if Sid is right. Is it just parents?
Yeah. I don't think it's just. Look, this is a partnership between parents and the educational sector. And I think Sid's right. It would be wonderful for the federal government to say this is a call to arms for us and a call to arm for every parent.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it's not an either or. We're not going to get out of this. I mean, look at Finland. We point to Finland as the country that is the greatest educational achievement. They have good parents and they probably have some bad parents. They have the highest paid teachers in the world and the best trained teachers in the world. And it's a federal policy to make that happen. And so they get the most achievement. Farah talked about the fact that, a lot of our STEM content teachers don't come from their field and they also didn't study that. And what our tests show in America all the time is that when kids do well in math and science, it's because they're being taught by people with master's level education in math or science. Mm. So it's not a parent can't only do that alone. They're not going to teach calculus, but they're essential to a kid succeeding in calculus. Mm. So it's just this either or conversation is unproductive.
Yeah. Let me bring in Bree from Morristown, who's on line one. Hey, Bree, you're on Studio 2. Would love to hear your thoughts on today's topic.
Hi, thank you. I am an online reading tutor for first through eighth grade. And my comment kind of connects with what you were saying about bringing more creativity into the lessons, because I find that my students, through, young kids to the older ones, really are terrified to read out loud. And that's basically the point of us tutoring. So my solution is to, I always say, like, I don't mind making a fool of myself if it gets a kid to read out loud. And so I try to bring in, my theatrical background and create characters, get them laughing, get them engaged. Because I think the other thing is that they lack the confidence in general, and also I think maybe they're scared of their own level of competency. And I was just wondering what your guests think about that lack of confidence in self and in skills.
Yeah.
Your thoughts,
thank you,
Donna, because
so
you were nodding along a lot there.
Yeah. The analysis of kids' sense of self-efficacy is very low.
Mm.
And I'm not quite sure what's behind it, but it is absolutely true. And it goes back to having amazing teachers who can key into that and can think of exactly the kinds of techniques she's using to get kids to incrementally build their confidence. Because you actually need some confidence to learn.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the negative thoughts keep you from engaging in the content.
Mm. Yeah. And like you said, it's not supposed to be, you can't give up. You got to keep going.
You
got to
keep going.
Yeah.
I had a couple of thoughts. One is that as we've been talking, it's important to understand how the test actually works, the report card actually works. So I think it's easy to slip into this idea that we're seeing kind of a progression. So that we're seeing students over time dip. But when in fact, what we're seeing is a new set of fourth graders, a new set from this is not the same 2019 fourth graders that are now being tested. And so we're seeing how they're progressing. We're seeing different sets. So it speaks to a larger kind of system issue. Mm-hmm. It's not about the individual student's performance and what we're doing there. So that speaks to a deeper challenge. But also having this educator speak about how she works on an online program was really great, because it's a reminder that this isn't all about schools. It doesn't all have to happen at schools. There's a lot of out-of-school time, what we used to call after-school programs that exist that support young people, help them build connection, help them build that confidence. And so not all of it has to happen in the academic setting, but we as parents and as educators and as those who care about young people should be trying to connect them to these additional resources that help buoy them so that they can take advantage of what's happening in the classroom.
Yeah, all around services, all around. Let's see if we can get another caller in. We have Jeanette from Northwest Philly on the line. Jeanette, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, it's actually Janet. I'm the parent of an eighth grader, and I just want to say that kids her age are struggling a lot, more than kids in ninth grade or seventh grade. They had only half of second grade and then all of third grade online. This is for Philly school kids, except for 10 days in person in third grade. And half of those days they had to take the PSSAs. So they are still have whole gaps that they didn't quite understand the first time around. And the school district as a whole didn't do a lot of remedial work for the kids that had these gaps. And I think there is a push from a lot of parents to limit how much the Chromebooks are used for their education. My kid does not get a lot from doing math problems online.
Yep.
Using paper and pencil, my son was in third grade last year. He got to write by hand a lot. It made a huge difference. So that's one thing that I just wanted to point out.
Thank you,
Great
Janet.
Great comment, Janet.
Thank you so much.
Anna points out poverty in the U.S. Far higher than in Finland. That's also obviously a factor.
Absolutely.
I would imagine you agree with that,
Absolutely.
Donna.
Absolutely, which means we have to do more. Not that it's a reason to do poorly, but it means we have to do more.
As we start to wrap up here, I think one of the big questions moving forward for both of you and everyone in this space is, where do we drive the dollars right now to make the biggest difference? I think everyone thinks we're behind, and perhaps we are on the verge of falling further behind. So today, where do we drive the dollars, the resources, the thought power? I'll start with you, Farah, and then Donna.
To me, it's a beautiful connection between good curriculum and good professional development. Teachers have to be part of the decision around that curriculum and the design of their professional development, because that enables buy-in and support. But ultimately, I think that has to be a winning combination in order to drive results for kids.
Donna, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think nationally the other response to this has been that we need to think about sort of tearing down the infrastructure of public schools. 9 out of 10 kids in America go to public schools, including charters. These are the results about charter schools and around traditional public schools. And so I think Farah's absolutely right. This is about teaching and learning, getting the best teachers in the classroom, paying whatever it takes to make that happen, and making sure every teacher has the support to be able to compensate for what we didn't do during COVID and for the impact of social media in their classroom. It's a new world.
Yeah.
We need new teachers.
And I do wonder if you're a parent hearing this, the alarm bells are sounding. If you were to tell the parents what's the one thing that they need to be doing to make sure that their kids fall, you know, don't fall
Read.
By the wayside.
Read.
Yeah.
They
and
got
take
to
the read.
Phone away for
take,
periods of time
on a,
and help young people sit in silence so that they learn to have the confidence when things slow down.
Well, really important lessons, I think, to share. I want to thank you both today for your time on Studio 2. You're both regulars. Of course, you're both welcome back. Farah Jimenez, President and CEO of the Philadelphia Education Fund. Thank you so much for your time today on Studio 2.
Thank you.
Donna Cooper, Executive Director of Children First. According to Farah, she knows everything, and she shared it all with us today.
Not true.
Donna Cooper, thank you so much for joining us on Studio 2.
Thanks. Great to be here with an expert like Farah.
Yeah. By the way, I want to say thank you to Gary from Mount Airy and Tom from Cherry Hill. Apologies we could not get to your call, but we get to do a little bit of a drum roll, because now it is time to reveal our DJ of the day, song pick.
Do we have it up, or do we have to wait, guys?
Yeah,
do we have it?
It's right here. It's "School Days" from 1976 by Philadelphia native and Roxboro High grad Stanley Clark. He's a jazz fusion pioneer as a bass player and composer.
And shout out to D.W. for choosing this track. Thank you, D. This sounds lovely. Let's hear a little bit.
Like a little jazz fusion. Thank you for that, DW. And thanks to our producers, Debbie Bilder and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, Al Banks and Tina Calique, engineer today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. General manager of audio here is Joan Isabella. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gray.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Thanks so much for joining us today. And as we get ready to wrap up, let me read a few more comments before we get to the end of our show. Elizabeth says, just my two cents as an educator. Number one, standardized testing. When I worked in a local elementary school, we lost 2 weeks to PSA testing. And number two, developmentally inappropriate expectations. Kindergartners are now expected to be doing academics for most of the day. Play is essential for our young learners. Shirley from Wynwood, I teach in a small private elementary school. The number of kids with learning disabilities and behavioral issues has grown astronomically over the years. I have to wonder how much this affects test scores. And Gail says mental health issues are a huge factor in the decline of all things related to students and what was once considered a normal childhood. Thank you again for your time today on Studio 2. We'll talk to you next week.
Oh yeah, next week.